Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's all right, everybody. Nothing to see here. Move right along. Ben Bernanke's got everything under control. What the Fed's latest stimulus really means for you and me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 14th of September, the first day of what could be a lifetime of quantitative easing. All right, that's probably not the way it's really going to go, but Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke did pretty much promise yesterday he's going to keep pumping money, that is liquidity, into the economy until things get a whole lot better. So we begin today with two stories of what that might mean for regular people. First up, from New York, Marketplace's Mark Garrison and the fallacy of a rising stock market.
If you're already quite rich, congratulations. Rising stock prices are great for you because the wealthy own a far greater portion of stocks than most Americans. But investment strategist Ed Yardeni says the rest of the country isn't getting a lot out of the latest moves.
Honestly, for the average individual who doesn't really have much in the way of an equity portfolio, what the Fed's been doing just doesn't seem to be having much of a positive impact on their lives.
Part of the Fed plan hinges on the so-called wealth effect, the theory that if people see their portfolio climb, they'll open their wallets. There's plenty of debate about how strong the wealth effect really is. Johns Hopkins adjunct business professor Roger Steger isn't sure whether even the rich will spend much more.
They might experience some sort of wealth effect on a limited basis, but then they're still continuing to buy luxury goods. Are they going to purchase an incremental addition to their luxury goods? Probably not.
Gallup polling shows just over half of Americans own some kind of stock, either directly or through their retirement fund. But stock ownership is at its lowest level since 2000. It's just not as broad as it used to be. Beyond people spending, there's the hope that rising stock prices could get companies to start hiring. Bill Miles is an economics professor at Wichita State University.
The company invests a little more, puts more in equipment. There'll be a few more draws based on that. But basically, the effects on the average person are going to be quite small.
Small, but not nothing. 401ks will rise, though it'll take a much broader economic recovery to offset the wealth destroyed by the financial crisis. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, so now the other part of it. The Fed's policy of keeping interest rates near zero through mid-2015 is clearly good news for anybody who needs to borrow money. Money for a house, or a car, or expanding a business, maybe even hiring a couple of people. But Mr. Bernanke said yesterday, if you've got other plans for your money...
Save.
There are going to be some downsides. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that slice of it.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be, says Polonius to his son in Act One of Hamlet. Though if Chairman Bernanke were playing the part, it might be more like, a borrower or a lender beest thou most certainly, but a saver, not so much.
It does have an effect on people like my mother.
Olivia Mitchell runs the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School. Her mom recently turned 90, her nest eggs sitting in CDs,
which she thought were going to be very, very secure for the long run and pay off enough interest until 100. So this is something that people that really were very risk averse, as my family was growing up during the Depression, was hoping to live on, and it's just not paying off.
Basically, Mitchell says, the Fed is picking winners and losers.
So across the board, it's pretty much a wealth transfer from the retired population to other sectors of the economy.
Like homeowners and stock investors. I ran this plan by some men at a local coffee shop. They were meeting to organize sailing races on the Columbia River this fall. Bill Symes is 65, a retired university administrator.
We're in a state of paralysis. We have money in safe investments. It's not been very safe. the pillowcase is probably the best place for our money right now.
George Euless is 29, and he owns a small business that sells sailboats.
And so I would much rather my customers buy product when they're comfortable, financially sound, and from their savings.
Euless says his personal financial conservatism trumps any economic opportunism he might feel as a business owner that the Fed's trying to help by pushing cheap money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On that topic, cheap money day two of QE3 was just fine with Wall Street this Friday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've come to that point long about a Friday afternoon where we take 4 minutes, maybe a little bit longer today, and figure out what the heck happened in the week gone by. Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. She is in our bureau in New York. Also, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He's down in Washington in our spaces there. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. Can we imply, and I don't mean to be a downer, but can we infer, I guess is the right word, from what the Fed did yesterday, that things were actually worse than we thought?
Actually, if you look at the Fed's forecasts yesterday, because in addition to making this announcement, they forecast what they expect the economy to do, they moderately upgraded their forecasts for next year. So, I mean, if anything, you could say that now they think things are a little bit, are going to be a little bit better than they thought. But, you know, they're still pretty lousy.
Yeah.
So, yes,
so
it's,
guess,
it's not that much of an upgrade.
All right. Sudeep, help us understand how what Mr. Bernanke did yesterday and said, because he talked for a long time, how's that going to translate into jobs, which he has said he is gravely concerned about?
Well, Ben Bernanke is making a fairly simple bet. He's betting that a stable stock market is going to be better for the economy than a collapsing stock market, and lower mortgage rates will be better than higher mortgage rates at this point.
Yeah.
And he's hoping that all of this will give boost confidence and give people more money to spend, which in the end can boost job creation. And there's some evidence to support both of those points. But he also seems to realize that this isn't going to really solve our problems. He was practically begging us yesterday when he was talking to acknowledge that the Fed can't fix our underlying problems. And when you look at the Fed action over the last few years, it looks like it has a fading effect, diminishing returns after a little while. And it's basically, once you've seen the magic trick twice, it's not really going to wow us again the third time around.
Yeah, let alone the third time. That's right. Now, Catherine, I mean, we just heard from Mitchell and Mark Garrison for a minute and a half, 2 minutes apiece about what this is going to do to real people. It's going to be a while, right, before mom and pop feel any of this?
If they do, that's the other question.
Yeah.
You know, as Sudeep was saying, that there are diminishing returns here. The Fed has already pumped a lot of money into the economy, has already put interest rates at, you know, sort of subterranean levels at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And if those interest rates aren't low enough now to get people to borrow money, it's not totally clear that it's going to have a huge effect going forward. I mean, besides the Sudeep was talking about how this could improve stock market returns, and that could make people feel richer. And we had this other segment about that. The other primary goal of quantitative easing is that if you make it cheaper to borrow, then theoretically companies and consumers are going to borrow more. But the concern is that interest rates have already been so low that this may not make that much of a difference.
Right. It seems to me what he's trying to do here is assume the rational actor, right? He's trying to assume that we're all going to behave rationally in this economy where we are still tentative at best, right, Catherine?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, there are people are worried about lots of things besides the fact that their potential mortgage rates are too high,
right,
considering
right.
they are very, very low right now.
Right, exactly. So deep down in Washington today, there was a little bit of political slash economic news. The White House came out with its report on sequestration. That is the big part of the fiscal cliff that's going to come at the end of the year and how it's going to react to all these budget cuts that were mandated in the budget deal last year. It's going to be a lot of money sucked out of the economy if it happens. But I ask it in the context of Ben Bernanke. The chairman of the Federal Reserve said yesterday, and this is almost a quote, he said, I hope it doesn't happen, the fiscal cliff. In fact, I don't think it will happen. Do you think that Congress is going to figure out a way to avoid all these spending cuts and make a deal on the Bush-era tax cuts that is going to stop all this money from getting sucked out of the economy?
I do know for sure that Congress will avoid doing anything important or controversial until the very last minute.
Cop out.
And in this case, whether we go over the fiscal cliff or not, just the battle over it is going to exact some damage to the economy. And what Ben Bernanke was really showing us is that he was willing to buy time to give the politicians some time to act. But every time you've seen that happen before, both in the United States and Europe, the politicians have proven themselves incapable of taking the baton. And yeah. That creates a really big problem, and we've basically bought time to get through the election and maybe hope that politicians will get their act together by the end of the year.
Catherine, quickly, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that there is an expectation that this will get resolved again, you know, at the 11th hour by Christmas, let's say, if we're lucky. But there's such a huge wild card with how Congress is going to behave after the election.
Yeah.
You know, usually you think, oh, a lame duck session means that it's easier to get things through because people have less on the line. But,
Not this time.
Congress has been behaving so erratically over the last few years. The debt ceiling controversy is one major example that who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Catherine Rampell from The New York Times and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend. Jay-Z, the musician turned mogul, was talking about Occupy Wall Street in the New York Times the other day. He said he doesn't know, and this is a quote, what the fight is all about. That from a guy who jumped from the 99% to the tippy-tippy top of the 1% himself, and who, by the way, made some money recently selling T-shirts that said Occupy All Streets. Monday, as it happens, is the first anniversary of the Occupy movement, and Dan Bobkoff reports that for now, at least, its legacy is more commercial than cultural.
It wasn't hard to find references to the Occupy movement, and the closest thing it ever got to a slogan. You know, the thing about the top 1% and everyone else. It wasn't long ago that I saw tongue-in-cheek ads around New York inviting 99%ers to occupy a self-storage company. Or there was this invitation from an online brokerage.
Interactive Brokers. Join the 1%.
Of which the Jack Donaghy character on NBC's 30 Rock is a member. Earlier this year, Donaghy got mugged by a guy wearing Dockers and saw the larger meaning.
This is a sign. The lower classes are getting cranky about the rich earning all of their money away from them. Can't they see this is in their best interest? How could we pay their salaries without using their money?
We're on the verge of a class war.
And Occupy hasn't made much of a dent in popular music. There is this song from Third Eye Blind, a band that was big in the 90s.
Come on, meet me down at the Cardi Park. Come on, meet me down at the Cardi Park.
It's not exactly Woody Guthrie. And whether you agree with Occupy or not, it was pretty clear that it never occupied pop culture, like past protests.
There wasn't one message. There wasn't one movement.
Natasha Leonard covers Occupy for Salon.com and has been involved in some Occupy actions herself. I met her in Zuccotti Park this week because she's written about the movement in pop culture. The tents and sleeping bags are long gone now, though we did find a small group planning something for Monday's anniversary. Leonard says Occupy was many people protesting many things. It was experimental and new, and isn't easily summed up in the kinds of messages that become songs, movies, or TV scripts.
The thing that resonated about Occupy was that it was genuinely confusing and very much related to how it felt to be taking those moments, seizing those streets. And it was not just a protest with a message or a petition.
Plus, Occupy's moment was fleeting. Paul Levinson is the author of the New Media.
Occupy Wall Street rose to prominence much faster than the civil rights movement and the anti-war movements in the 1960s, and it was over, so it seems, much faster.
Too fast to end up in, say, movies while the protest was still going on.
It was not around on the front page or as the lead story on television long enough for the impact to spread into popular culture.
In spite of that, some started seeing Occupy everywhere, like in this ad for Maybelline, full of beautiful protesters.
What do we want?
Something we can believe in.
Baby lip!
That became a debate over whether Maybelline was co-opting Occupy. Some saw the movement in the new Batman movie. It seems Occupy is now in the eye of the beholder. Or at least it's on 30 Rock, which ended that episode about class war with its own Batman parody.
Villains and heroes, the 1% and the 99.
In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Before we go on, this correction from the show on Wednesday. Our story on a new special edition car that Chrysler is putting out with the fashion designer John Varvatos turns out, sadly, that Neiman Marcus is not featuring that car in its Christmas catalog. Coming up, you know how people say their pets become part of their family?
I certainly would want to know where a person's intentions lie. Do they really love my pet, or are they out for the dough, for the pet's dowry, so to speak?
Till death do us part. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street ended this way today. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.4%, 53 points, closed at 13,593. The NASDAQ charged up 0.9%, 28 points, 3,183. The S&P 500, why it jumped 0.4%, 5 points, finished at 1465. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained 2.2%. The NASDAQ added about 1.5%. The S&P 500 picked up 1.9%. Kraft Food is going to leave the Dow Industrials. United Health is going to move in, and the switcheroo played better at United Health, up 0.6% than at Kraft. It fell 0.4% today. Apple started taking pre-orders for the iPhone 5 today. Yeah, it's sold out for now. Investors cashed in. The stock dialed up 1.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. Heads up, Space Shuttle flyover. Endeavour begins its journey west from Florida to California, where it will spend its retirement on display. Endeavour makes the trip mounted atop a modified 747. Events at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia mark the 225th anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. And Moulin Rouge director Baz Luhrmann turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The discount retailer Daffy's is going to open its doors for the last time tomorrow. The chain with 19 locations in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and is thus liquidating its entire inventory. Sally Herships reports now on where everything goes when everything has to go.
If you're a shopper, a sale can be something to celebrate. But at the Daffy's at 18th Street and 5th Avenue in Manhattan, looking through the racks felt like going through the really big closet of someone who just died.
Actually, I'm very, very depressed at their clothing. I feel like it's affecting me personally. I really feel that way.
Mackenzie Granger says he's been shopping at Daffy's since he was 15. I tell you how many years that is, but he's very cagey about his age. Let's just say you can measure it in decades. Today, he's keeping his friend Andrea Swabi company while she shops, because he's done with Daffy's.
It's too painful.
It is. It feels like you're being affected personally because, you know, all these people are not going to have jobs. Because it's, even though you're shopping, selling, you're buying stuff, you're still thinking, like, you're like, I feel like almost I'm a vampire, almost, you know.
But not all the shoppers are that sensitive. Marcia Wilson is a longtime Daffy's customer, though she says she hasn't been in the store in a while.
And was it the signs that brought you back in this time?
Of course. Yeah.
Have you been looking at any of the actual, like, furnishings? Because those are for sale, too. Like,
yeah,
the
I saw the shelves over there for $5, but I had no use for them.
But the store is closing tomorrow, so who's going to buy all this stuff? The sweaters, the shoes, the shelving? Well, that's where a liquidator comes in. They come up with a plan to close the business. It covers marketing, markdowns, and staff. Liquidators get a flat fee or a commission of 4 to 10% of sales. The whole point of liquidating the store is to raise cash to pay off Daffy's creditors.
Well, I mean, maybe there are some debtors who wear a specific size and have a specific fashion taste and would accept Daffy's sweaters or apparel, but I doubt that.
Bill Engrick is CEO of Liquidity Services, Inc.
The reality is that you settle, you know, these obligations in cash.
Angrick works with clients like Walmart, Best Buy, and Home Depot. He says companies regularly liquidate last season's goods for cash. It's part of the normal, healthy business cycle. So Liquidity Services sells goods by the pallet or truckload. Their customers own small businesses or resell goods on eBay. And just like the individual shoppers at Daffy's New York store, they don't want to pay full price. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Brad Stone has a pretty good full-time job. He's a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, but he is not above getting his hands dirty for a good story, and he's got one in this week's issue. It's a digital twist on the age-old practice of paying people to do odd jobs for you. People in cities around the country are plying their skills in, say, basic home repairs or latte delivery by answering instant ads on their smartphones. Brad Stone, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai.
So this is kind of a crazy story, man. It's a little bit part-time work. It's a little bit temping. It's a little bit handyman. What is this thing you did?
That's right. I noticed this summer that there were a lot of startups here in San Francisco that are part of a trend you might call the distributed workforce. They're putting little micro jobs, you know, on their websites, on their apps on smartphones, and they're trying to get workers to come clean houses or wash cars or put together IKEA furniture. These are sites like TaskRabbit and Postmates, and I just decided, you know, heck, I'll take a week and I'll go do these jobs.
All right, so how'd it go?
It was exhausting. I scampered back to my keyboard as quickly as possible.
You call it short, back-breaking, soul-draining journey into what Silicon Valley venture capitalists call the distributed workforce.
It really was. And, you know, I made some mistakes along the way. I spent the first day doing jobs on the website TaskRabbit. What you want to do on TaskRabbit is focus. You know, I weeded somebody's backyard. I cleaned somebody's house. I am not a house cleaner. I did a terrible job. I broke down some boxes for a guy. I made about $110, $120 for a day. It wasn't bad, but at the end of the day, I could hardly move.
How does it work, though? You load this app on your phone or something, and then you bid on these jobs, what you think you can do it for, and you try to win with the lowest bid?
That's right. There are some others that are similar. There's one that's really interesting called Cherry, and it's basically a car washing app. Somebody could order a car wash, and a crew comes and washes their car wherever they've parked. And basically, you go, and these jobs come in, you race over to their car, and they've got a whole system, and you wash their car.
The thing is, this sounds goofy, but there are venture capitalists putting tens of millions of dollars into this thing.
You know what? It's actually a kind of a smarter idea. It's what economics called a two-sided market. You're basically matching demand that may not have existed. You know, lots of people trying to assemble their own IKEA furniture or not washing their cars. And you're matching those jobs, those micro jobs, with people who may be unemployed or underemployed, who may have some excess time on their hands. And, you know, these companies are actually, you know, they don't have much infrastructure. They're matching supply and demand, and they're trying to remove the friction, make the payments easier. Some of them are showing some early promise.
What happens if it doesn't go well, if you don't? I mean, you had one cleaning experience where you were, in point of fact, a lousy cleaner.
That's right. I was terrible. And what happens is you get bad ratings. You get bad rankings. And so for a marketplace like TaskRabbit, well, I might be much less likely to get that kind of job in the future.
But can you make a living at this? I mean, you know, weeding somebody's yard for $40 in an afternoon is not going to pay the rent.
I can say definitively that I cannot make a living at it. But the thing is that some people are doing well. You know, TaskRabbit is the oldest, and it's a couple years old. And I talked to some folks that are doing quite well. And look, I mean, the alternative for them might be unemployment.
Brad Stone, he's a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. His piece in the new issue is called My Life as a TaskRabbit. It's a pretty good read. Brad, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Pets, cuddly and companionable as they are, can run you a pretty penny. You got to feed them. You have to board them when you're out of town. Take them to the vet when they get sick. Maybe splurge and buy them a super cute witch costume for Halloween. Or not. But what happens when you're not around to do all that stuff anymore? Who's going to take care of Fido then? The ASPCA wants more people to start considering their pets when they do their estate planning, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill tells us.
I'll admit it. When I got assigned this story, I giggled. I mean, pet estate planning? It seems like a concern of a very, very small percentage of us. Those with standard poodles and Bichon Frises out there. The Leona Helmsleys of the world, right?
Not at all. Not at all. Quite the contrary.
Okay, I stand corrected. Kim Brissant-Kibwe is a lawyer with the ASPCA. She says it's not just a rich person thing. Everyone should plan ahead.
There's a lot of situations where people don't leave money at all.
Lawyers say the most important thing is to put in writing who will take care of your pet. Have it in your will, a legal trust, or contract. If you don't have a plan for who's going to take care of Buddy...
People don't know who to give the dog to.
Attorney Rachel Hirschfeld specializes in pet estate planning. She says if no one steps forward...
Your dog will most probably go to a shelter and be euthanized. Those are the numbers.
The experts also recommend you keep a pet dossier, a document with information about Scratchy's drugs, his vets, and whether he eats wet food or dry. And if you are one of those people lucky enough to be able to set aside money for your pet, Brissant-Kibwe says don't start a conversation with a potential guardian there.
Because I certainly would want to know where a person's intentions lie. Do they really love my pet, or are they out for the dough, for the pet's, dowry, so to speak?
Got to keep the gold diggers away from the yard diggers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
These final notes today, two of them, just because they're both great and I couldn't make up my mind which to pick. First of all, sweet, sweet relief for parents trapped in the seventh circle of Disney World down in Orlando, Florida. The Los Angeles Times reports today that for the first time in its 41-year history, the resort is going to serve beer and wine in one of its restaurants, just what you need to take the edge off. I can confirm, by the way, from firsthand experience, that Disneyland here in Southern California has already seen the light in that regard. And also this, completely unrelated but still amazing, Halliburton, the oil services company, has misplaced a key piece of equipment. The search is on across a 130-mile slice of West Texas for a 7-inch-long radioactive probe it uses in fracking, hydraulic fracturing. The Texas Department of Public Health says if you see it, the radioactive probe, that is, best not to pick it up. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, begins on Sunday. And Rabbi Adam Kligfeld has a question about that.
It's clear how to go into a food store as an observant Jew in terms of what food you can and cannot eat. But how do you go into an electronic store as a Jew and make that purchase be Jewish?
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.